From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and a historic meeting is taking place right now at the White House between two men who have distinctively different visions for the country. President Obama and President-elect Donald Trump are discussing a peaceful transition of power. And joining us now is NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And Ron, we haven't heard from them yet. We're waiting for them to come out or maybe say something that we can hear. But what might they be talking about?
They will be talking about some of the mechanics that are involved in just moving one staff out of the White House and moving a completely different staff into the White House. Some of the responsibilities, some of the things that have to be done, some of that includes national security information. And much of it is fraught because these two men have had such a difficult relationship. It's fair to say that Donald Trump was moved to finally make good on his promises to run for president by his antipathy towards the Obama administration, and certainly fair to say that Barack Obama has been more vituperative and dismissive of Donald Trump than anyone else in the public sphere.
Do you expect Obama to try to convince Trump while he's in there to, you know, leave some of his executive actions in place or anything like that? Or do you think they won't be getting that specific?
That seems unlikely. There's so much for them to talk about. This is a first face-to-face meeting between the two men. That's a little surprising in terms of American politics for someone to get all the way to being president-elect and never to have even shaken the hand of the current president, or for that matter, have ever to be involved with him in any sense, have any sort of a speaking relationship, any sort of a communication. But Donald Trump is our first president-elect who has not held public office or been a military commander. So he really is coming from a different world, and they really have to start at square one. And it's probably way too early for President Obama to try to persuade Donald Trump to do anything or not to do anything.
What are we learning about Trump's administration and what it's going to look like? We've heard the names floated of Newt Gingrich as a possible Secretary of State, Rudy Giuliani as a potential Attorney General. What else are we learning about what the Trump administration is going to look like?
The Trump administration is going to take shape over probably a longer period of time than other transitions have taken. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that the man who is at least putatively in charge of the entire transition is New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who suddenly has a new phase to go through in terms of the Bridgegate scandal back in his home state, which has resulted in the convictions of a couple of his former associates. As a result, he has to think about that, and he has to think about how much of a symbol for the Trump administration it is proper for him to be at this moment. The Giuliani rumor about Attorney General has been around for a long time, although lately some of the things that Rudy Giuliani has said during the campaign about going after Hillary Clinton, about how she shouldn't be pardoned by President Obama as though there were something to be pardoned at this point, that kind of thing is usually not what gets somebody appointed Attorney General. But again, this is a unique set of circumstances and a new kind of president. As for Newt Gingrich being Secretary of State, that would certainly send a certain kind of message to our overseas relationships. It certainly would be non-conventional. And we are hearing that a lot of the people that might normally be considered for some of these foreign policy jobs or national security jobs have already taken their names off the list, have already said, please don't consider me. I don't want to be part of this administration.
What about what he'll be able to get done with Congress? We've already heard Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, come out and say, well, term limits, that's not going to happen in this Senate. But I think back to 8 years ago, and President Obama came in with a much bigger Senate majority and a Democratic House, and he was just barely able to pass the Affordable Care Act. Is Trump going to be able to get a lot done with this Congress, does it look like?
It might be possible for him to work with Congress to take down a lot of the Obama administration's legacy, starting with the Affordable Care Act. And they have spoken about making that job one. But that will require, in all likelihood, either some extraordinary procedures or waiting for budget reconciliation later in 2017, or winning over enough Democrats to defeat a filibuster. Right at the moment, that last option does not seem particularly likely. So being so far away from 60 votes, it looks like they're going to have 52 Republican Republican votes in the Senate, they're going to have to figure out some way to work with Democrats to do really big things. By the way, Mitch McConnell also made it pretty clear he was not considering building the kind of wall that Donald Trump has been promising.
That's Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Ron, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Largely black protesters chanting CPD, Chicago Police Department, on Tuesday in a largely white Chicago neighborhood where police and firefighters live. The protesters were demanding an investigation into the shooting death by police last weekend of 25-year-old Joshua Beal, who police say was armed. We've been taking a look at the number of shooting deaths in Chicago, and most of them are gang shootings. 4 were killed last weekend, 6 the weekend before, 78 in October. We've been checking in with Chicago Sun-Times crime reporter Frank Main, who explained to us the algorithm behind the city's strategic subject list, which targets potential shooters and shooting victims and tries to get them out of gang life. Let's pick up that conversation. Frank, start with your calculation that there are 100,000 gang members in Chicago.
At least. So what's happened in Chicago is they used to be able to kind of count this fairly accurately, because when somebody would come into the Cook County Jail, they would tell the intake people honestly whether they were in a gang or not. And the reason is they didn't want to be placed in a part of the jail with a different gang and, you know, get attacked.
Get killed, right.
So, right. Yeah. So there were, you know, tens of thousands of people who were, quote unquote, documented gang members who had gone through the jail system. The complexion of gang problems in Chicago has really changed in the last 10 years. It used to be almost like corporations that operated with CEOs and called the shots from the top, and now it's totally diffused onto street corner gangs that control their own block and fight the gang next door to them. So there's no sense of unity in many of these gangs anymore, and the reason is that the feds came in and blew up the top levels of these gangs through RICO cases. That's what we have in Chicago now. We have tens of thousands of these guys, but they're not really answering to, you know, to a grayhead who's running the show anymore.
Well, this is part of why this must be insurmountable, because unless you send somebody out of the state, if you help them get out of a gang, if they're surrounded by 999,000 other gang members, there's no place that's out, you know, unless you leave the city.
That's right. I mean, so the feds tried one strategy, which was Project Safe Neighborhood, where they would tell gang members that they would send them out of state so they would be away from their family members, and they really didn't like that idea. That program, I don't think, is as robust as it was maybe 10 years ago, but that is one thing that they had tried to do.
And then there's the strategic subject list, again, using an algorithm to identify potential shooters and shooting victims. We asked, does it work? Well, on the front end, it does. You know, we're reading that so far this year, more than 70% of the people who have been shot in Chicago were on the list. This is according to police. More than 80% of people arrested in connection with shootings, the perpetrators, were on the list. So somehow the algorithm has found them, but it's not translating into stopping them.
Right. A couple things. First, it's a very time-intensive, and, you know, they have a police commander who runs a major district in the city, has to take time out of the day to go to that person's house and knock on the door and get all these other people together to do this kind of intervention. So there are a lot of people on this list that have not yet been talked to. That's one thing. Second thing is that a lot of these guys don't really trust the intentions of this program. So even though you might make that contact, it might not be successful. Mm. There are a host of other things that are going on right now as well. For example, Chicago is currently under federal investigation by the Department of Justice, which is looking at our police practices.
Well, and we know that the relationship between the community and police has been frayed by very public shootings. There are suspicions that the police are doing a slowdown because they feel that they're the ones under investigation and being scrutinized.
That's right. I think if you were to put one finger on it, I think that would be it. Gangs in Chicago are now emboldened, I think more than ever, to go out and commit crime and feel like they can do it with relative impunity. And the police are not as proactive as they might have been even a year ago. The reason for that is a number of things. I mean, first of all, it's this police slowdown, but also the actual number of homicide detectives who are out there investigating these shootings is way down from what it was a decade ago. I mean, at one point they had like more than 1,400 homicide detectives, and now it's somewhere around 850. And the rate at which they are solving murders is woefully low. It's around 26% of the murders get solved. You know, if you are out there and you think you can get away with 75% of the murders that occur in the city, you might, you know, not think twice about doing it if you were predisposed to kill somebody.
And what about guns? We reported on this as well, that first of all, the number of felons that have guns in Chicago, which is, of course, illegal.
Right. So surrounding suburbs, as well as other states, they essentially are a pipeline for guns in Chicago. I have talked to people, you know, on the street recently who say that almost everyone they know in certain networks, like we were talking before, certain networks of people, you know, almost everybody is carrying a gun, you know. So I hate to use this analogy, but it's kind of like the Wild West out there right now because so many people are packing heat in Chicago. Hmm.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning Chicago Sun-Times crime reporter Frank Main. In our ongoing conversation, we don't want to stop this, our ongoing look at Chicago gun violence, for a conversation on Chicago's gang algorithm and how it works, go to herenow.org. So what happened to the polls? Nate Silver's vaunted 538 put Hillary Clinton's chances of winning at 70%. And she did win the popular vote by 200,000 votes and counting. But Republican strategist Mike Murphy tweeted on Tuesday, "I've believed in data for 30 years. Tonight, data died." Did it? Our next guest says maybe it was misinterpreted. Whit Ayers is a GOP pollster and president of North Star Opinion Research. Marco Rubio's just one of his clients. And Whit, you're thinking about how incumbents poll. Tell us about that.
There is a well-established principle in polling with incumbents running for re-election that what you see is what you get. In other words, if you're at 48 as an incumbent and your opponent is 45, we will frequently tell our incumbent candidates that they're in trouble if they are below 50 and if they are at 48% and the opponent is at 45. The reason is that frequently incumbents get the number at the polls that they have on the final survey.
Theirs isn't going to get that much better, but their opponents might.
Their opponents are generally not saddled with the image of incumbency, and so frequently undecided voters go disproportionately to the challenger. And the issue here is whether or not Hillary Clinton was, if not technically an incumbent, effectively an incumbent, running for the third term of Barack Obama. And let's just take a look at a few of the numbers here. The national polling averages had Clinton at about 46%. At the end, she ended up with 48%. In Arizona, the poll was 45. She got 45. In Florida, the poll was 47. She got 48. In Ohio, the poll was 43. She got 44. And in Wisconsin, the poll was 46. She got 47. It seems like more than a coincidence that the number she had in the average of polls at the end of the race is remarkably similar to where she ended up on the final ballot.
However,
but Trump made substantial gains, as frequently challengers do.
Well, now talk about that. Couple things. First of all, we're understanding people didn't understand the margin of error. There was a headline in the New York Times last month that said, when you hear the margin of error is plus or minus three, it's really seven. In other words, it could be 7 or 8 points difference, and that's still razor tight. But also, we're hearing over and over again now that especially in this anti-politics as usual electorate, a lot of people did not tell the truth. I mean, people are out and out telling reporters, I lied. I don't like pollsters. I don't like Washington. I lied. Do you think that was a factor?
Robin, if that were a factor, our own polls wouldn't have been as accurate as they were.
You mean North Star?
Yeah, at North Star. And a lot of our competitors will be able to demonstrate to you as well that their polls were very accurate. I don't believe that there is a consistent pattern of lying, but I do believe that many of us, and I include myself in this, interpreted the polls at the end as leading to a Clinton victory, which she did get in the popular vote, but she did not get in the Electoral College. Trump put the pieces together the right way in terms of the map. he didn't necessarily win more white voters, but he won the right white voters, and that allowed him to win numerous large states by one percentage point. Yeah. Florida, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin.
And just to remind ourselves, that's what the Electoral College is all about. It's not about getting the most votes, the popular vote. It's about making sure that you get votes that represent the entire country across the country. And so he did snag votes in those areas that got him the electoral votes.
That's exactly right.
That's Whit Ayers, GOP pollster, president of the North Star Opinion Research Firm. Thank you so much, Whit.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And by the way, we're reminded that when the Cubs were down 3-1 in the World Series, they were given the same chance of winning as Donald Trump. So Hillary Clinton's 70% meant there was still 30% for Donald Trump.
Tomorrow is Veterans Day, so let's hear one veteran story. Michael Regan was a Marine who served in Vietnam. Today, he's an artist in Edmonds, Washington, and he says he received a phone call one day that changed his life. Erica Lance from Here and Now contributor Kind World has this story.
The call was from a woman who wanted to commission a portrait of her husband. He was a corpsman in Iraq who had died the year before. For Michael, the request was personal. He had been a Marine in Vietnam and was still haunted. In his most vivid memory, one of his fellow Marines bled to death in his arms. They were both 19 years old.
He just looked me in the face and said, "Mike, I just want to go home." And he looked at me, closed his eyes, and died. Then we covered him with a tarp. But I've seen that face for 48 years every day.
Michael says that when he returned to the U.S. as a Vietnam veteran, people spat at him, and no one seemed to understand what he'd been through. He felt as if he'd left part of himself in Vietnam.
Like you dug a hole and buried that part that let you feel.
So in 2003, when Michael heard from this widow, he decided without hesitation to draw her husband for free. He mailed her the black and white pencil-drawn portrait, and when she received it, she reached out again.
She said, "I'm calling you today because yesterday when I opened up the picture and looked into my husband's eyes, I was able to reconnect instantly. We talked about things that we hadn't finished talking about when he died. I ended my conversation with him, telling him I loved him." She said, "I felt him say he loved me back." And she said, "For the first time in a year, I've slept all night."
When Michael hung up the phone, he turned to his wife and said,
"Now we need to do them all. Our whole life's about to change."
Michael decided to draw every service person who died in Iraq or Afghanistan and give the portraits to their families. Before long, he quit his day job and burned through savings to execute his plan. Step one, learn all he could about each person he'd draw. Talk to family members, watch videos, read diaries. Then pick up his pencil.
I start with the eyes. I create a life in the picture so I can have someone to talk to.
He says it's like he and the dead service member are in the room together. He does 2 portraits a day, about 13 by 18 inches, drawing for 10 to 12 hours. When he's done, he goes for a daily 5-mile walk and often weeps.
I spend a lot of my life looking at dead people, and I'm not going to pretend it is hard. So on my walks, what I do is transition. It allows me to say goodbye to the people I just drew.
He's been doing this for 13 years.
I said initially it was going to be 5 years and 1,500 portraits.
As of now, Michael's drawn 4,753.
This is my life. And it took me a couple of years to understand what that really meant. It took a comment by a Gold Star father one time. He said to me, "You know what you're getting out of doing all this work, right? Your soul is getting to come home from Vietnam." When he said it, I knew it was true.
Still, there was something missing. And it had to do with the man who died in his arms in Vietnam in 1968. He tracked down the man's name, Vincent Santinello. Then he connected with Vincent's nephew, Ralph Morales, who told him he'd always wanted to learn more about the uncle he never met.
When my uncle died, a big part of my grandparents died with him. They never spoke about him. There was always that palpable sadness. My mom's best friend at the time told me that people actually would call the house and start screaming into the phone, "We're so glad that baby killer was killed," cursing at my grandparents who had just lost their son. My grandfather at one point got so distraught that he ripped the phone off the wall, threw it out the window, and took all of Vinny's belongings, all the letters Vinny wrote home, and burned everything because he couldn't take the torture.
As he listened to Ralph, Michael had a profound realization.
I said, "It's your uncle's face I see every day, in every drawing I do." I think that moment that your uncle looked at me and died and said he just wanted to go home has been the driving force inside of me for years.
My uncle, he has a legacy, and I never knew that. He's been living for years in these portraits that are hanging in people's homes all over this country.
46 years after he held Vinny in his arms, Michael finally drew the portrait he'd been trying to create all this time. He gave it to Ralph.
And he unveils the portrait. The eyes just stood out to me. And for the first time, really, I felt like I met my uncle.
There was still one other person Ralph Morales wanted to share the portrait with.
I arrived in New York early that morning, and I had the portrait with me, and I realized what I had to do. I jumped in my car, and instead of going home and going to sleep, I drove straight out to the cemetery, and I placed the portrait against a tombstone. And my uncle is buried in the same plot as my grandfather. He never got to say goodbye to his son, and he died sad. I was definitely crying. A combination of sadness, yet euphoria. And I remember sitting there with the portrait, talking to my grandfather, saying, "Dada, Vinny's here.
Vinny's home now."
For Here and Now, I'm Erica Lance.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
Donald Trump's election set off protests last night in dozens of American cities, like Los Angeles.
Do you want to live in a country that is led by a man that says racist, sexist, biggest country?
And angry students stage walkouts on college and high school campuses. Teachers often face challenges around contentious elections, and many are using this one to teach about the complexities of the electoral process. Tanya Mosley from Here and Now contributor WBUR takes us to a classroom in Lowell, Massachusetts.
It's Wednesday, the morning after, and history and political science teacher Robert DeLosa wakes up and says to himself, "How am I going to tackle this in my class?" DeLosa had been following the presidential polls, and frankly, he hadn't prepared his students for a potential Donald Trump win.
It's going to be a bit of a scrum.
And so DeLosa rushes to his 12th grade political science class at Lowell High School with an idea. Let the students lead the discussion.
One sheet per group.
They all get into groups of four and write down 10 questions they each have about the outcome of the presidential election. A group of 12th grade girls huddle in a circle and start writing. 18-year-old Shelby Sawtell stops and looks over at her classmates' questions.
Why couldn't the Republican Party find someone other than Trump?
There had to be someone else. Like, really, what's his name, Paul Ryan?
He could.
Nearly 60% of Lowell High School students are Latino or Asian. DeLosa says he's gotten an earful from kids who are downright afraid of Trump becoming president.
Almost overwhelmingly, there's a lot of anger. There is disbelief and fear because some of our students who are immigrants are asking, well, what's going to happen with us? Are people going to come after us?
There are also many students who come from white working class families. tucked in the corner of the classroom, four 17-year-old boys, including three Trump supporters, put down their pens and start talking. 17-year-old Joe Burke leads the conversation.
I actually went to the Trump rally in Lowell in January, and it was very electric. It was very exciting. Like, you could see the passion and the energy within the people. Like, these people wanted to vote.
Burke says it's actually been hard to be vocal in school about his support for Trump. This moment in class is therapeutic.
It's either you hate him or you don't.
And the Republicans swept everything this year, the House, the Senate, the White House
now.
I feel
like there's going to be a lot that we're going to have to repair.
17-year-old Brian Arias breaks into the discussion. He says most of election night, he watched his mom console a friend.
She called my mom. She constantly called my mom, just checking up on the elections. And she kept crying. She kept calling my mom, crying, because Trump was winning, just because she's Dominican and she doesn't have her papers.
Class is almost over, and Delosa has a student stand up to read the top questions among the class.
Why do we still need an electoral college? Why was Trump still nominated as the Republican nominee despite the fact that his party did not approve of him? How did the media affect the election? To what extent did gender and race play a role in the election?
These seniors will spend the next few weeks exploring the answers to these questions. Delosa says for the students on the cusp of adulthood, this impromptu exercise is a way for them to feel empowered to make their voices heard for the next election. For Here and Now, I'm Tanya Mosley.
The coming presidency of Donald Trump is something few imagined a year and a half ago when Trump entered the race as a real estate mogul and reality TV star. In May, former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort called the campaign the ultimate reality show. And now, here we are. David Brin is a futurist and a science fiction author who's written about the possibilities and realities of a culture where cameras are everywhere. He's with us on Skype from San Diego. Hi, David.
Nice to be with you.
And Justin Vaughn is also with us from Portland, Oregon. He's a professor at Boise State University, where he focuses on American political institutions and the presidency. He's also edited a book called Poli Sci-Fi, An Introduction to Political Science Through Science Fiction. Hi, Justin.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. And I want to start with you, David. What do you think about that idea of a presidential campaign as the ultimate reality show?
Well, this has certainly been experimented with, even in science fiction films. We've seen this, everything all the way up to Idiocracy. We've seen the notion of the running man and all of this. And it reflects on our historical past, where we cringe when we think that our democracy may head in the direction of bread and circuses, where the Roman Empire kept the masses under some degree of sway by offering them massive and expensive and bloody entertainments. But on the other hand, science fiction sometimes does explore the possibility that technology and the future might enhance our ability to act as sovereign, independent citizens. And we're seeing this in what the other news from this election, and that is the number of referenda and ballot measures that citizens take very, very seriously and study very hard. And apparently, over the years, in my impression, have done a very good job.
Justin, what about you? What do you think about this idea as the presidential campaign as the ultimate reality show? And certainly, on both sides, Clinton and Trump, you've got people who are very famous. They're very well known. They've been in the spotlight for a long time.
Yeah, I think that that is not an inappropriate or unreasonable comparison. And I don't think that it's a new thing. I mean, presidential elections for a long time have been staged events. There's some sort of reality that's happening, and maybe we capture it on tape sometimes. But by and large, both the presidential campaign and the presidency itself are this kind of series of prepared and, you know, semi-real stagings that convey to us some approximation of what is apparently happening behind closed doors. President Obama has been kind of historically critical of Trump as a candidate and even kind of tepid in his embrace of him now as a president-elect. But it's a little ironic if he were to, you know, criticize Trump for, you know, becoming the first reality television president, because, you know, President Obama has approached his time in office in kind of similar ways, right? A lot of time spent on late night talk shows,
right,
and ESPN and slow jamming the news and visiting Oprah and Ellen. And so
do you think that you have to be a celebrity or kind of a rock star kind of figure in order to be president in the United States right now in a country that is much bigger population-wise than it was even a few decades ago. You've got to be well-known by enough people who are going to vote for you.
Yeah, I mean, to win, you know, 100 million votes, you've got to be famous. What you're famous for, of course, is, you know, still kind of up for debate.
Well, David Brin, one of the things that's different about this campaign than any previous campaign is how much time these candidates have had to spend on camera, being recorded, not just by the media, but also by individuals who have their phones out. We know so much about them. What does that do to a candidate to be in the spotlight so many hours of so many days?
My personal belief is that the cameras had much less to do with it than the physical proximity of thousands of people during those rallies. I think that those absolutely changed Donald Trump. I expected him, by the time the debates came around, to do a veer toward the center to try to grab the center on a number of issues, like, for instance, changing the Republican stance on climate change. But he did none of those things, and I believe it's because of the rallies. I think he was getting a very, very potent emotional high off of those rallies of tens and thousands of people and playing up to them. And I think that this may make the presidency problematic for him. And we may see him head out to the road very quickly in his term to get that high from the rallies. And this is old fashioned. This is not technology. Technology does drive some of these changes. But in this particular case, I don't think it was.
Well, Justin, let me go back to you and ask if you think that every candidate is going to have to be like this now. They're all going to have to be not just celebrities, but out in the public all the time and in front of the camera all the time, just in order to run this country.
I think that you're certainly going to have to maintain a public presence. The extent to which you make yourself, you know, totally available, that may not be necessary, but certainly the handlers of candidates and presidents will have these kind of strategic considerations that they make about how available they make their candidate, how they deal with the, you know, inevitable damage of when things you would prefer to keep behind closed doors come out. Increasingly today, I think there are no more secrets, you know, whether it's WikiLeaks or videos of Billy Bush or any number of other things, right, that everything is going to come out of the woodwork. And I think we'll see that continuing. You know, so in a way, that kind of running for a major office like that is kind of this political panopticon, right, where, you know, everything you do is seen. And so one of the advantages, I think, that Trump had over Clinton in this election in that context was that he embraced that and kind of and accepted that that was the reality and campaigned, especially during the primary, in a way that worked. Whereas Clinton kind of held to this more traditional approach of, you know, trying to control information, trying to make sure that only what you wanted was out, and to keep everything else, you know, locked up. And it didn't work, right? Those things came out, whether it was through WikiLeaks or whatever. And every time they did come out, it would only kind of reinforce this suspicion that, you know, large numbers of the American people had that, you know, she was too secretive or not trustworthy or whatever.
Well, so, and we don't know how Donald Trump would have reacted if it had been his emails that were being released by WikiLeaks. He might not have liked it quite as much.
Oh, for sure.
But do you think that this is going to discourage people from getting into politics that otherwise would have because they don't want to deal with this kind of new world that we live in?
I think perhaps, especially kind of in the near term. But, you know, I wonder if in the future, you know, maybe a few election cycles down the road, if we just acclimate to this new reality and begin to kind of ignore the kinds of things that might derail a candidacy today, right? Something comes out about something terrible you said 10 years ago, and unless you're really, really famous and a billionaire who doesn't need donor money, then you have to drop out, right? But in the future, maybe it's kind of, yeah, everybody has their private lives and we all do stupid things and sometimes terrible things, and that just doesn't become as big of a deal because we've got almost complete information about everybody.
David Brin, your thoughts on that?
Well, first off, I do disagree that Donald Trump had things that were hidden. I mean, of course, the entire history of his financial actions and his tax records were successfully, and this boggled the people on the other side, that he was able to get away with, that his followers didn't care. That I think, segues over into what Justin just said, and that is that what you're going to care about in the future, what people are going to care about. Young people are castigated for posting things online that they know 30 years from now, 20 years from now, even 10 years from now, they'll be embarrassed by, they'll cringe over. And I believe that it's something almost psychological at a deep level, sociological, where the young people are thereby wagering, they're betting their futures that they're going to live in a society that is more tolerant of little non-harmful but embarrassing stupidities that they did earlier in life. And I believe that that is, Justin is right about that. I think that we're going to have to do that. We had a local Congress fellow running against Daryl Issa down where I live, and he had had a restraining order put against him for 1 week when he was in a divorce. And he's a United States Marine colonel. And this was used against him savagely by Issa in repeated commercials, even though the ex-wife was now campaigning for him. But the point is that in the future, his rebuttals will be automatically tagged to the commercials that are slagging him. And so we may have a somewhat more fair system if adults choose to use it that way.
That's David Brin, a futurist science fiction author who's written about the possibilities and realities of a culture where cameras are everywhere. And we've also been speaking with Justin Vaughn, professor at Boise State University, where he focuses on American political institutions and the presidency. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks. Great for being with you.
Thank you.
And let's take a little break from politics, shall we?
To the Cow Palace in San Francisco come 20,000 spectators for the grand finale of the Grand National Rodeo.
The Grand National Rodeo has brought livestock shows, team roping, and bull riding to San Francisco since the 1940s. But most of the spectators probably don't know that one man has produced this and nearly every other rodeo in California for 50 years. He can really say, this isn't my first. Cotton Rosser is the owner of the Flying U Rodeo Company, a rodeo legend. Lacey Jane Roberts of Here Now contributor KQED caught up with him at the Monterey County Fair.
Next to the tent where local 4-H kids are showing off their prize-winning pigs, the rodeo arena stands empty. It's 2 hours before showtime, and workers are bustling around the backstage area getting ready. Cotton Rosser doesn't bustle around much anymore. He's 89 years old. Right now, he holds court on a plastic patio chair, dressed in a turquoise pearl snap shirt and a big white hat.
No, fine, thank you. How are you guys? How'd the sale go? The loveliest people are in rodeos. They do it because they love it. And it's a Western way of life, and they love the animals and the horses and the outdoors and the atmosphere of rodeo. It's just barbecue and fun.
Cotton has been honored by nearly every cowboy, rodeo, or rancher Hall of Fame there is. But he was actually born a city kid in Long Beach in 1928. He grew up reading cowboy books and watching westerns.
Oh, yeah, Gene Autry, Roy Rogers, Hopalong Cassidy.
Cassidy's too much of a man to shoot in the back. Come on.
Oh, I want to be a cowboy my whole life, yeah.
Cotton was barely a teenager when he got a job on a ranch on Catalina Island. It was World War II, and school was only in session half the day.
Well, they had 3,000 cattle over there. Wrigley did. Wrigley Chewing Gum. They owned the island at the time, and I worked over there as a kid. I cleaned stalls and cleaned the manure, and they'd let me ride a donkey named Jack.
He graduated from donkeys to bulls and saddle broncs and started entering amateur rodeo events. By the time he was a student at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, he turned pro. He competed in all the big rodeos.
Cow Palace, Las Vegas, Reno, Calgary Stampede, all the rodeos, Cheyenne, Pendleton.
He even won the all-around cowboy title at the Grand National in 1951. Then, in 1955, he was working on his ranch north of Sacramento and had a run-in with a post-hole digger that broke both his legs and ended his career as a national rodeo competitor.
Best thing that ever happened to me, so I quit.
He quit competing, and he bought the Flying U Rodeo Company.
There's been songs written about it.
I was snapping out broncs for the old Flying U. At 40 a month, a plump good buckaroo.
He started his career putting on rodeos and breeding and raising animals for events all over the West. That was 1956. Today, Flying U is the oldest continually operating stock contracting company in the United States. Cotton says he kept the company going through changes in the sport.
Might do some good at the big rodeo.
When I started, the rodeos were, they had five events. They didn't have girls barrel racing. A lot of them didn't have team roping.
And sometimes it seemed like they were running out of rodeo fans. To bring more people to the arena, they had to get creative.
Oh, Monterey, California, and it is Saturday night. It is go time. Are you ready? Let's try this one more time. Monterey, are you ready? Let me hear you.
Cotton calls Flying U's new rodeos showdios. Mixed in with the bull riding and team roping are t-shirt cannons, rock and roll, and freestyle motocross.
Do what we call the sideline. Oh, wow.
And in recent years, Cotton says these new attractions have boosted attendance. That includes the Grand National Rodeo at the Cow Palace in San Francisco.
That's the daddy of them all. Last year, we broke a 10-year record on the attendance, and it went real well, and the Cow Palace is on the way back.
Kelly Ferreira works at the Cow Palace, and he's known Cotton Rosser for 30 years.
Everybody knows him. Yeah, he's an absolute legend.
Cotton no longer runs things quite like he used to. In the past several years, his son, Reno Rosser, has taken the reins of the Flying U Rodeo Company. Cotton says the business is a family affair, and there's no question he's going to stay involved.
People catch up with you if you slow down. No, I love what I do, and I love going, and I'll be on a horse and be a big shot.
Not that Cotton can be missed. He's the old cowboy on horseback circling the arena, wearing the big white hat. For Here and Now, I'm Lacey Jane Roberts.
And now you know. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.